24/7 Radio Network, broadcasting from AM and FM stations around the country. Welcome to the Small Business Administration award-winning School for Startups Radio, where we talk all things small business and entrepreneurship. Now, here is your host, the guy that believes anyone can be a successful entrepreneur because entrepreneurship is not about creativity, risk, or passion, Jim Beach.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another exciting edition of School for Startups Radio. As always, we sure do appreciate you being with us. We're here to try to motivate you to get off the sofa, go out there and take over your life and actually do something that you are proud of that you can pass on to the next generation. We're trying to give you the tips, the tricks, and the techniques to be successful as an entrepreneur. And I appreciate you being with us. We have a great show today. Paige Wiese is with us. She is with Tree Ring Marketing, has built an incredible business, bootstrapped it. She has a great ignition story or birthing story. It's just a great interview. I'm really excited for you to meet her. She also gives out a free tool at the end, a great resource that you should go out and get. And then after that, we have one of the most famous entrepreneurial thinkers, Simon Sinek. His video on why has some 30 million views, I believe. And it's interesting because his thesis directly conflicts with our thesis here. I don't care what the why is. And Simon and I get into a little bit of an argument about it. It's one of the feistier interviews that I ever remember doing. Simon is obsessed with why, and so is the vast majority of the entrepreneurial world. All of them disagree with me, but I'm still fighting my fight. I feel that the why is almost an elitist response trying to block other entrepreneurs from going out there and getting started. You know, you don't have to have a license or anything to be an entrepreneur. You can just go do it. It's harder to become a beautician than it is an entrepreneur legally. And that, I think, is part of the problem. All professions like to create barriers to entry so that they can do it and it's harder for you to do it. And when the government doesn't step in and help with that, when the government doesn't create silly rules to help big business against little business, then the entrepreneurs have to come up with something on their own. And I think that's what we are encountering here. I believe that you could be very happy with your why being, I want to make money. Oh, that drives them crazy. They just hate that. They think that, oh no, you have to be, you're there for the environment. You're saving the environment. You're saving children. Your business is designed to sell, but in the end, it's going to save children. Whatever, whatever. I believe that's great. If you can have a why, you are in the bonus territory. However, if you don't have a why, I don't want you sitting on the sofa waiting until you find your why to get started. That's the worst thing that can get happen. And so many people hear Simon talk and say, why? And they go, oh, I don't have a great why. I won't start my business. Very frequently, I have discovered that the why comes after the business. I started a business. I had no idea what my why was. My why was to have a job, to make money so I could feed myself. And Simon hates that. What your why has to be there. Well, my first business, I didn't discover the why until I was 3 years in. And it was a great business and no one would start it and look at it and go, oh, you can't do that business. You don't have a why. The why came eventually and that's good enough. And so I don't want you sitting, doing nothing and blaming it on the why or the creativity or the risk. And so listen to Simon and I talk about this, argue it out a little bit, make your own decision. And if you love my idea, great. If you love Simon's idea, great. Go find your why. I hope you can. A lot of people don't. And then they sit on the sofa and work for the man. Anyway, great show. Thanks for being with us. We'll get started.
Time to talk and no action on climate change? Introducing The Real Environmentalists, the bold new book by Jim Beach. It's not about activists, politicians, or professors. It's about the entrepreneurs, real risk takers, building cleaner, smarter solutions, not for applause, but for profit. The entrepreneurs in the book aren't giving speeches. They're in labs, factories, and offices, cleaning the past and building clean products for the future. The Real Environmentalists is available now because the people saving the planet aren't the ones you think. Go to Amazon and search for Real Environmentalist. Thank you.
We are back in again. Thank you so very much for being with us today. I'm very excited to introduce my first guest. Please welcome Paige Weiss to the show. She is the founder and CEO of TreeRingDigital.com. They are a high-ranked Denver-based marketing agency that works with high-performance websites, and they have a particular niche. They deal with companies that have many, many different brands. They've just released a new digital asset management service to track and protect all of your brands across 200 different data points. Very impressive. Paige, welcome. How are you doing today?
Doing well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
My pleasure. So, I mean, I have my brand trademarked and stuff, and that's really all I need to do, my lawyer said.
For your brand, it's a very, very good start. But when we look at what is the full brand online, what does your full digital presence look like, your website is still a part of that. You still have copyright to your website. All of those things go into it. So while there is just a trademark, there's way, way more that goes into it. But I think that's a very common misconception that people run into, like business owners run into, especially as they're getting started.
So tell us about your clients and the problems they're dealing with.
Yeah, so we work with a variety of clients across a variety of industries. And the types of things that we kind of get the phone calls for is, while we focus on website design and development and online advertising, we see a lot of clients enter the door with, I don't understand why this is happening. I don't understand why my website's down. I don't understand why my emails are working. I don't know why I can't move my email from here to there so that I can, use Google Workspace instead of Outlook. I don't understand why I can't log into my Facebook business account to actually run ads. All these different types of things that come up when they're trying to either run it on their own, or a marketing team that's trying to like get a little bit further, but maybe a little bit outside of their, you know, skill set, if you will. That's where we really start to see, you know, clients coming in the door so that we can start building long-term relationships with them.
And how many brands does a typical client have?
Typically, like most businesses are going to have one brand. However, as you start to merge and acquire, you're going to develop multiple brands. And how do you want to start focusing on that integration piece as well? Are we bringing over the branding of all of the brands and keeping everything independent? Are we merging them into one brand? What does that look like? So typically we're working with clients that have the one, but as we continue to see our clients grow, we do start to see that they have more and more brands start to come into play.
I just bought a new Step and Repeat, and I have five logos on it. So I have five brands, right?
If those aren't sponsors and those are your brands, yes, absolutely. Then you've got five brands.
Thanks.
Yep. So exactly. You've got five brands around that then and how you're working. Like, for example, TreeRing Digital, we've got about two or three different brands that we operate under. And so you're correct, you know, as a business and from a strategy side and a marketing side, you do start to develop a variety of brands. And with that, I always tell clients those like 200 assets that we were talking about is now a minimum of 400. Or in your case with five, we're now moving it into like 1,000 different assets and data points that go into having that many brands.
So just to let everyone know, I was 48 years old before I found out what a step and repeat is. How old do you think you were, Paige? And what do you think the average, I don't think the average person knows what a step and repeat is. What are your thoughts?
If I hadn't been to so many like awards or nonprofit events, I probably wouldn't have known either. Even being in marketing, it's not necessarily, you know, to your point, one of the things they talk about right away, just the way that we work with clients. I probably had a little bit of a jump start. I would say probably 28 or so when I found out what it was.
Okay. Yes. So for those of you who don't know, a step and repeat is a backdrop. It is usually vinyl. It rolls up and is on the metal rack, and you can put it up in the middle of a convention center hallway, and everyone stands in front of it and gets their picture. I have one that I'm going to use for my video calls with my brands behind me. If I'm on a video call, I might as well be advertising my brands, don't you think, Paige?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, instead of, yeah, like which one do I do for this call or having a different backdrop depending on, why not put them all up there, right?
Well, I have School for Startups Radio. I've just started my own publishing company. And this is the first time ever saying that. This is, you're the
oh, congratulations.
One to bring this out of me. It's called Startup Publishers. Dun, dun, dun. And if I have the brand behind me, one out of every 10 guests will ask, I'm assuming.
Exactly. And I mean, yeah, I've been on podcasts, yeah, where they've got their book right behind them. And it's
that's
super helpful. Like, I prefer that you have that than your actual logo. Like, this is something I can go buy right away instead of, oh, I'm just staring at a logo of a company I may or may not already know something about.
Yes. How did you birth Tree Ring? Did it hurt giving birth to a whole tree?
I mean, I was already a pretty low. I was coming out of architecture and
You're an ex-architect?
Yep. Oh, 2008 is not the time to be doing that. Thank you. Yes,
Paige, a quarter before graduation at Georgia Tech Master's Program of Architecture.
Oh, it might have been a blessing. I mean, look at where we're both at now, right?
I never wanted to be an architect. I would give anything to be an architect. But by the point this was, we're back to 1996 now, the Atlanta Olympics were coming, and they lost the entire campus because of that. And on an ongoing basis, I bought for the summer rights for, guess what? The architecture building was mine every summer for the next 10 years and kicked all of the architect professors out of their offices for June, July, and August. They weren't allowed in the building because it was mine. And here I am going into my Christmas time desk crits right as my in my graduating year.
Oh, man.
That's a story, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's... The way that it just like the architecture industry is so crazy, and I really enjoyed it too. And like, there
tell
are
me briefly about it. Give the listeners a brief rundown of why it's so crazy. Give us a little recap.
I mean, I got into it because I wanted to do line drawing. I wanted pen and paper to the, you know, like that's how I wanted to do it. I showed up to class the first day, and they're like, "Pull out your computers. We're diving into CAD." And I was like, "Oh, I thought that's just what they were teaching me in high school. I didn't realize like we weren't ever touching a pencil
vellum.
When we get into this."
Give me
right? I want the blueprints, like physical blueprints, not, oh, we mass printed on a large printer. And so, you know, that was part of it. And then as I've like watched it all evolve, like I want to design really nice homes. That's what you think you're going to get into. And then next thing you know, it's nothing but a bunch of like rinse and repeat apartment complexes or, you know, commercial buildings that are almost all identical. And I'm just like, I would be bored. I would be bored out of my mind, especially using a computer, because it is just copy, paste, copy, paste, copy, paste. And so, you know, those pieces, and it's just so unpredictable. Are we going to overly build apartment complexes due to where everything is at and how people are moving in? Or are we going to switch back to residential? Are we doing townhomes now? And like, you have to just quickly like, oh, okay, well, I guess we're shifting gears. That's what we're going to do. So yeah, I think I would have been way too bored had I stayed in it, even though I absolutely love the component of building and I love the component of drawing.
Very well said. That is very good description of the industry from what I understand. I have one good friend who does super high-end houses. He's from my class, and he's now at Atlanta's number one firm that does the $5 million homes and stuff. Mm-hmm. And he said the hardest part of his job is that the average client is spending more on doorknobs than he gets paid a year.
Oh, I can see that. I can see that. I think it was the third, or no, it was only 2 years ago, like a year and a half in. I remember one of the professors saying to us, like, by the way, if you came here to make money and that's why you chose this industry, like, you chose the wrong industry. And I was just like, why did you have to wait like a year and a half to tell us that? Like, you probably could have started that on like day one, but like, we were already a year and a half into a 2-year program. And it was like, okay, so there's that. But you're right. I mean, it really is interesting how much they'll spend, or they just don't appreciate architecture anymore. You know, like the little details, how do we do this? The builders don't want to build the little intricacies that go into it. They just want to get it up and get moving to the next. And so I think the art of architecture has also really been lost over the years.
I want to get back to tree ring, but just, I want to throw out one more thing. I've been obsessed recently with YouTube videos on Chinese construction and all the things they've built in the last 20 years. That concrete, you can grab it with your hand, and destroy it with your hand and rip into the column holding up your house. Or 20-story tower. All of this economic miracle that we're seeing in China that we've heard about is built on fake concrete, people. Anyway, you obviously knew something you wanted to say about this.
No, I was just saying, like, one of the ones earlier was the forms and the way that we use cinder blocks, and then they come in with concrete forms to get some of the decorativeness on the concrete sides, right? And how they make that happen so that they're still getting the art into it instead of, let's just throw a bunch of cinder blocks down and cover it with, you know, a light coat of concrete and call it a day.
All right. Back to tree ring. So you were decided to leave architecture and
I was unemployed. I was just like, what do I do now? Like, okay, this is twice in this industry that I've been laid off. I'm 23. I don't know what to do or where to go. And I was just like, I don't know. Like, let me just try to build a website or two. Let me just put some ads up, see if I can get some work. I don't, you know, what is it going to be? Is it graphic work? Is it websites? I don't care. And, but I had never built a site before. So that's what I was saying. I really had nothing to lose. I didn't know what I was doing. I was already at kind of a low for me at that point, and just put myself out there and started teaching myself website design and development and really found a knack for it and enjoyed it.
HTML? And WordPress,
all the way back. WordPress? HTML first, and then learning into WordPress from there. It was still really early days for WordPress. Yeah.
Okay. WordPress is visual, people. Like, what you see is what you get visual. HTML is behind that. So it's easier to learn WordPress than it is the HTML behind it. I recommend to everyone, learn WordPress and then start hitting the code button and seeing the code that produced what you just did visually. And so that's a way to start learning it. A very impressive page. And so have you gotten to Python and stuff? Where did you quit and just outsource?
I mean, I have a good understanding of everything through PHP, MySQL, JavaScript, all of that. And that's kind of, you know, where we, because of how WordPress is structured, that's really where we need to stay. We are diving a little bit deeper into some of the React stuff and different things as it starts getting into how do we start bringing AI integration into websites. AI is a very powerful tool, as we all know, up until the point. And how do we start merging and bridging that gap between AI and website interface?
Well, let me just share this story. I was obsessed with a couple of things this weekend. One was obviously YouTube, and the other was ChatGPT. And I was working on a website in WordPress, and I got stuck and it was broken. And so, you know what I did, Paige? I loaded it into ChatGPT and said, this is not working. I want it to do this. How do I fix it? And ChatGPT gave me an answer, and I played with that and I couldn't get it to work. And I went back to ChatGPT and said, I can't get that to work. And it said, okay, we'll do it your way, which I just loved. I just loved when ChatGPT told me that. Oh, we'll do it your way. And it gave me a different way to solve the problem. And I did. And I got the website I wanted through using ChatGPT. I was really impressed with myself.
Yeah, it's, you know, if you can guide it well enough, it'll get you someplace. I mean, but to your point, you know, there's a lot of people that think they can just jump into ChatGPT and build a website or even some of these AI tools and just build a site. But so much more so goes into it as far as user experience. What type of content? Do you know what kind of messaging is going to sell on your website? Do you know where and why you're placing call to actions, where you're placing those? Do you know what to consider a conversion when you're setting it all up? How do you link your email and email marketing into the website. Those are all things that it's like, yes, ChatGPT will get you mostly there, but you still have to understand the terminology and like what your actual desired output is. Otherwise, you're right, it's going to give you something, or it's just going to give you, okay, I added that code, but I didn't know where to add it, so I just broke my site. And we get that call a lot. I broke my site. I don't know what to do. How do we recover it? And thankfully, being in business this long at 16 years, like, we've seen a lot. So it's usually pretty quick for us to fix, but it's stressful for a business owner trying to do it on their own of like, who do I go to find extra help when I'm not getting what I need out of, say, something like chat.
No, I just want our listeners to do it for the first year and the first $100,000 and then hire you.
Yep. Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, how do you get started kind of, and that's how I got started, right? Like
exactly.
When I started Tree Ring,
we interrupted the story, but keep going. We'll come back to
this. Oh yeah. I was just like, I have no money. I'm literally just like taking an unemployment check and putting it towards my bills. And like, that's all I have to live off of. So I, you know, was like, I have to build my own site. I have to figure out how Craigslist can, you know, works to generate business, like all of these things. And so I absolutely agree. Like, get an understanding of why, what, you know, what is the most important thing to get your product to market, and then start fine tuning. Or I also tell clients, start with the 5-page site just to understand and have a professional presence, and then build into all the individual service pages or add all the extra products or whatever that looks like. But I've pivoted my business a couple of times because they thought, oh, you only do websites. All right, let me rebrand so they understand I do more. Oh, I don't understand what that is. What do you do now? Okay, well, let me rebrand so I can do this. And like, we've got about 100 pages or more on our site now, but that's an evolution of time. That was us listening to the customers. And so I very, very much think you're right of, hey, just get something up. You will be finessing it the entire time as you continue moving. And that's a lot with the digital assets too, is it will continue to evolve and you need to be ready for that.
So tell us about your new product for protecting multiple 200 brands at one time, and or the data points. Tell us about that.
Yeah, exactly. So it's really 200 data points per like one brand, if you will, one company. And so what it looks like though, is what we started to see is there's this gap and disconnect as businesses continue to grow, which is, hey, the owner handled so much up front. Then they started bringing on either VAs or employees. And then they started bringing on vendors and outsourcing it. And then they started bringing on, you know, outsourced teams, whatever that looked like. And everything has been pieced together over the years. There's no one really taking ownership of like this whole digital presence that exists out there. And so there's a lot of confusion. And a lot of business owners just don't actually understand even what they're buying sometimes when they're working with a vendor. Or a lot of times they just tell an employee like, yep, go for it. You've got my approval. Sign up. But, you know, if we kind of take that employee route a little bit further, what email address did they use to sign up? What credit card did they put on file? Do you know when that credit that expense comes out? Do you know how to recover that account should something happen to that employee? And what does that all look like? And that's just for one, you know, like a third party tool, if you will. It could even just be a plugin to your WordPress website. Who owns the license key that is making your builder work? Is that you? Is that the developer? If you aren't working with that developer anymore, do they remove the license key or do you get to keep that? So those are, that's just like one little example, but it covers everything from like domain names, emails, and hosting to your marketing tools, which could be social media platforms. It could be your Google Analytics and Google My Business, into what you mentioned, brand assets, like the logo files, step and repeats, your marketing collateral, all of that into your third-party tools, and then also looking at backups and crisis prevention and compliance. So there's about 7 different pillars that these different assets fall into, and we just, no one's really taking control of what that looks like, and that's where we're starting to see a lot of digital chaos as we go through.
How did you get your first $10,000 customer? How far in was that? Year 2, year 3?
That's a good question, because 10,000 can come in 2 different ways. It can be, is it like a $10,000 website? Is it a $10,000, you know, ongoing monthly marketing? What does that look like? And I guess the way I'd really rather position that is, you don't know the value of a client until you start working with them. I had a client that I was literally just doing tutoring once or twice a week for a couple hours at their office or their home. I just show up, we throw a computer down, and I just start teaching him WordPress because he just wanted to know. And he has been a client of mine probably since 2011. And I can't even tell you, you know, what just this hourly consulting has turned into, one for like our, my business, our relationship, the amount that I've learned in return. So, you know, I really like to stress that with businesses getting started is it may feel like, hey, it's $85. Why am I doing this? But you don't know what the lifetime value of that customer really is. Because yeah, 10,000 probably added up pretty quickly, but I wouldn't be able to tell you which specific client, you know, got me to 10,000, you know, as a client income right off the bat, because those little things added up for us more.
How many employees do you have now? With
vendors, we've got a team of 15.
I'm sorry?
We've got a team of 15.
Very impressive. So cool. And have you ever brought money in, or do you still own the 100% of the business?
Oh, thankfully, I still own 100% of the business. It's been very nice.
Do you hear the applause?
Yeah.
What's the number one factor that got you to here? Was it patience, skill, connections, haircuts? Why did you make it 15 years where so many people tried that exact same model and petered out?
Yeah, that's a great question, especially in this space with freelance and how many like contractors exist in website design, marketing, all of that. I would say our ability or my ability to listen to clients and really move and adapt and like shift what we're doing and offering based off of the feedback that we're receiving and what we're seeing is working and not working. And two is mentorship and like getting a business coach, surrounding myself. I took every free course I could when I got started, because my background, as I mentioned, was not in business. So, you know, as you can imagine, learning taxes, payroll, HR, legal, all of that stuff, in addition to just trying to learn your trade in general, I really just dove in and like, what can I do in town that is free that's going to get me someplace? Because again, I bootstrapped. I didn't have the money, and I couldn't invest $10,000 into some big sales, you know, thing for just to know it may or may not work. So, those would be the two big tips that I would say really got to us to where we're at today is Tree Ring.
Great, great advice, Paige. How do we find out more? Follow online, hire Tree Ring.
Yeah, you can follow us online at treeringdigital.com and also on LinkedIn. I am more active on Paige Weiss on LinkedIn than the company page specifically if you're looking to connect with me. And then you can also go to treeringdigital.com, School for Startups. And we've got a little bit more information on our digital asset management, but more specifically, we also have a digital asset management checklist that you can download for free that will start walking you through what are these assets that I need to be paying attention to, what should be on my radar, and how do I start closing some of those gaps. And just a really, really amazing tool. I think that businesses need to be, you know, taking a look at any phase of their business, but also as they're kind of getting started, might as well start with a really good foundation first.
Thank you so much for that free tool. We will put that in the notes and blast that out on the social media as well. I love your logo, the Tree Ring logo. It also looks like a hand to me. Is it supposed to? Have you thought of this? Anyone ever said that?
Not the hand. Sometimes I wonder if it looks like a clock, but for the most part, representing the tree rings and a very modern version of.
Why does it have the cuts in it?
Just the tree's unique, you know, they've got little hiccups along the way and Okay. Things that come up.
Great stuff. Paige, thank you so much for being with us, and we'd love to have you back.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed it.
And we will be right back.
Tired of talk and no action on climate change? In Introducing The Real Environmentalists, the bold new book by Jim Beach. It's not about activists, politicians, or professors. It's about the entrepreneurs, real risk takers, building cleaner, smarter solutions, not for applause, but for profit. The entrepreneurs in the book aren't giving speeches. They're in labs, factories, and offices, cleaning the past and building clean products for the future. The Real Environmentalists is available now because the people saving the planet aren't the ones you think. Go to Amazon and search for Real Environmentalist. Thank you.
Welcome back to School for Startups Radio. Thank you so much for being with us today. I am very excited and honored to introduce you to our next guest. His name is Simon Sinek, and of course, he is one of the most famous authors and thinkers out there. He is best known, of course, for his book, came out in 2009, called Start With Why, How Great Leaders Inspire Everyone to Take Action. Just 2 years later, it was ranked the number one top best-selling corporate read by CEO, 1-800-CEO-READ. I'm not sure what that is. But anyway, he started off in the advertising space, and in 2002, he started his own company called Sinek Partners. He has got a new book out last year called Leaders Eat Last, Why Some Teams Pull Together and Others Don't. Simon, welcome to the show. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
I'm very fascinated. You know, I've read Start With Why, and I have also taught for about 10 years at a big downtown university. I'm concerned that the youngsters today, the 20-year-olds, don't even have any clue of their why. Why for them is almost the furthest thing from them. Do you have this concern with me, Simon?
Well, you know, there's a lot of data that says that young people today, you know, want to work for a company with purpose, which is a funny conclusion, because everyone on the planet wants to work somewhere that has a sense of purpose. It's not exclusive to any age group. But I will agree with you that I think this youngest generation doesn't understand or struggles to really find that thing that they're looking for. And I think it's partially because of the world they grew up in. You know, they grew up in a world of instant gratification. They grew up in a world where if you want to watch a movie, you can watch it whenever you want to watch it. You know, you can watch a TV series right now. You don't have to wait till the following week. You can order something on Amazon. It'll arrive the next day. You can text your friend. They'll respond to you immediately. You don't have to leave a message on a machine and wait 3 hours for them to call you back. Everything is instantaneous. And the thing that I've found in talking to them is that they view that their jobs and their career fulfillment the same way, which is, I meet so many of them, they're smart, they're driven, they've got good work ethics, and yet they work at a company, they work there for 1 year, they're entry level, and they want to quit because they don't feel like they're doing anything of value. And what they realize is these things take time, that living a life fulfilled is not something that happens at the click of a button. There's no app for that. So I think there's this strange impatience in an entire generation. Really fascinating. I mean, just look at the way they're taught to build businesses. You know, they see all of these tech startups that go from zero to multi-billion dollars after being in business for 2 years. You know, that's the equivalent of making a business plan based on winning the lottery. That's what happened. Those companies won the lottery. That's not actually how you build a business. And yet they feel if they're not billionaires in 3 years, there's something wrong with their businesses.
Can they be changed and fixed? Should we even try? Or do they just need to wait? Just let them grow up?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. The challenge is, again, as they explain it to me, this is based on relationships. As you and I both know, great companies don't win the lottery. Great companies have people who feel a part of something and have devoted their lives and all of their blood, sweat, and tears to help that leader's vision come to life. And the thing that is required for that is relationships, deep, meaningful relationships, trust, cooperation. You know, we care about the people with whom we work, and our leaders care about us, and we can feel it. And I've spoken to lots of this generation, and they tell me, they're very candid about it, that they struggle to form deep, meaningful relationships. And so I think as leaders, you know, for people who have companies, who have these young people who work with us, it is incumbent upon us to help guide them like we would our own kids to form those relationships. For one, are we taking a chance on them? Or, you know, are we telling them our failures and giving them opportunities fail? Or are we holding them to the, or do they believe that there are these standards? You know, I'm very often leaders say, you know, my door is always open, you can always come to me. And yet we forget that sometimes they don't have the courage to ask for the support that they desperately need. Are we teaching them human skills? In other words, how to communicate, how to have conflict, how to negotiate. You know, you walk through an office these days and people, so many Gen Y, have their cell phones, you know, between their arms in front of their keyboard as they're typing them, you know, they're not actually engaging with each other. They bring cell phones to every meeting. You know, they can't go out for dinner with each other without putting their phones away. And it actually does great harm in their ability to form deep, meaningful relationships. We as leaders can create better conditions. We as leaders can create conditions. We can create environments inside our companies where our people fall in love with each other, where it becomes a real family. And it's incumbent upon us to do that. And absolutely, they can change. And when they do, they will fall in love with the company they work for and be devoted tirelessly to help that leader's vision.
All right. Excellent. Simon, awesome. How can we then, as small business owners, when there's, say, 3 to 5 employees, and that's the major demographic of this listening audience today, speak to leadership to that demographic. How do you lead and inspire that when there are 3 people in the office? And maybe, and let's be very honest, one of them's probably your brother-in-law, because so many entrepreneurial companies are built incestuously.
Sure, sure. Now, let's be clear what leadership is, right? Leadership is not a rank. Leadership is a choice. Leadership is a responsibility. Leadership is not about being in charge. Leadership is about being responsible for those in your charge. And so I know many people who own companies, but they're not leaders. You know, we do as they tell us because they have authority over us, but we wouldn't follow them. And yet I know many people who don't own companies who absolutely are leaders. They may be very junior in the company and they're leaders because they've made the choice to look after the person to the left of them and to the right of them. And for one part, it's for those leaders of those companies, with even if 3 to 5 employees, to understand that the success that you hope to enjoy is incumbent on the hard work of the people who work with you, not for you, right? And that we work for our people, that we have to afford them opportunities, we have to give them responsibility, we have to offer them vision, clarity of vision, we have to offer them the ability to learn and hone their craft and try and make mistakes and fail and try again without fear of losing their jobs, you know, just if they happen to have make a mistake or have a performance issue, that we coach them to see them grow. That is the responsibility of the leader. And especially in a small company where we all know each other's names and, you know, we are family, for that leader to devote themselves not to their own success but to the success of their people, that's a huge, huge, huge transition, a huge step for many business owners to make. But it's absolutely essential to enjoy that long-term success. And in time, what starts to happen is your own people come into work more devoted to your company and the success of the company than they are to themselves. You know, it's really a magical thing when a company with 2 to 3 people, that one of the employees comes in and says, "Hey, boss, I need you to cut my salary because we can't make payroll this week," as opposed to, "What are you going to do?" You know? It's pretty inspiring when your own people are willing to sacrifice because they believe in you. The only reason they'll believe in you is if you believe in them.
Or if you eat last, the perfect segue to your book, right? And I love it. When I was thinking about this, it also comes to mind that the boss has to work harder than everyone else. I worked for the Japanese government, Simon. It's my very first job out of college. And my boss took a nap every afternoon and woke up at 5 or 6. And we weren't allowed, you know, and it infuriated me and it drove morale down. Yep. And then I built a business in the 90s to 700 employees. And I worked harder than anyone else. And I never, ever had any morale issues. Speak to your new book, in Eaters Eating Last.
Yeah, So that's entirely right. Too many people who achieve a position of rank or authority, notice I'm not saying leadership, right? Who achieve a position of rank or authority think that because they're senior in the pecking order, that entitles them to do less. Nothing could be further from the truth. If you choose to be a leader and you accept all the perks that come with rank, you make more money, you get a better office. You know, people hold the door open for you, they make you tea, things like that, you know? If you choose to accept all the perks that come with rank, it comes at personal sacrifice, and that personal sacrifice means you have to work harder. You set the tone. Leaders set the environment. Leaders set the tone. You know? And so To say that I've earned the right to take a nap is absolutely backwards if you afford your people the same luxury. If we all take a nap, that's fine. But yes, that's correct. Leadership is like parenting. It's a 24/7 responsibility. It's not something you do just at work and you stop doing it when you go home. It is a lifestyle. It is a lifestyle you choose to live. And it is, as I said before, taking responsibility for the people in your charge, which I don't know how you turn that off.
Simon, you've lived all over the world. I remember Hong Kong, South Africa, London, and New Jersey of all wonderful
that's
selection
right. Exotic
there.
Exotic New Jersey, yes.
Yeah.
You from should... Hong Kong to exotic New Jersey, that's true.
When you look at leadership around the world, I, as I mentioned before, work for the Japanese government. I also work for Coca-Cola in Japan. And I see Asian leadership as very, very distinct. Which leadership styles are you fondest of? Do you like certain things about certain leadership trends and characteristics that you've seen around the world?
Sure. You know, every culture has its advantages and disadvantages as it comes to leadership. The fundamentals of leadership are exactly the same all over the world, because the fundamentals of leadership are based on our own biology and anthropology. In other words, it's about being human and how people work together in groups. But of course, there are advantages and disadvantages to every society. You know, I'm a big fan of America, I'll tell you that. You know, America is a reason it's such an entrepreneurial society, is we don't look down on failure the same way, say, the Europeans do. You know, in Europe, if you try and fail, it can really that hurts. I met a Spanish entrepreneur who, he made a lot of bad decisions. He takes full responsibility in his company, and he lost everything. The company went bankrupt. And he tells stories of how he would go into restaurants, and people who were his friends would turn around and pretend they didn't know him.
Wow.
simply because he had failed. We don't have that attitude in the United States. You know, here, we love that somebody tries, even if they fail. We just love that they tried.
Especially if they dust off and go again.
Yeah, we love it. Dust off and go again. And that's really something very special in a society that, you know, for entrepreneurs, that is the societal attitude. The other one is the way we view hierarchy. As you know from working in Japan, hierarchy is very, very strict. This produces some problems. It produces some problems that when mistakes happen, people are afraid to say, "Hey, boss, we have a problem." We know this from the Fukushima accident, that nobody spoke up, that they all knew full well that something bad was going to happen and they could have taken preventative measures. Malcolm Gladwell wrote about this. He wrote about how Asian airlines have more accidents than American airlines, the American-based airlines, because of the strict hierarchy in the cockpit, you know, where if there's a mistake, if there's an accident, if there's a problem, that the pilot won't question the captain. We in the United States have a much better track record just simply for our ability to speak with each other and speak to each other. Now, that requires a strong culture as well inside the company, and it requires good leadership as well. But as I said, there are some basic societal advantages just for the way things are. However, Japan, in contrast to America, offers intense loyalty to their people. So we use mass layoffs to balance the books. Think about that. That we think it's important to destroy someone's livelihood so that we can make the numbers for 1 year. So in Japan, that doesn't happen. You know, you work for one company for your entire life. You offer loyalty to the company, but more importantly, the company offers loyalty to you. That's a huge advantage that the Japanese have over us.
All right. Very good. Thank you, Simon. I love that, especially the analysis of Japan. It's interesting. You mentioned that there are some fundamentals of leadership that are the same around the world. Give us one or two of those. What is a universal leadership truth?
So human beings are social animals, all of us. We respond to the environments we're in. You can take a good person and put them in a bad environment. They're capable of doing bad things. Likewise, you can take a bad person, someone society's given up on, may have even performed bad acts, and you can put them in a strong and positive environment, and they're capable of doing good things. They're capable of turning their lives around. This is a universal truth. In other words, we all respond to the environment we're in. And no matter what the culture is, we will respond to the environment we're in. When we sense that our leaders are devoted to helping us achieve success and helping us grow, if we sense that our leaders would sooner sacrifice the numbers to save our lives, then the natural human response, trust and loyalty. In return, we offer our blood, sweat, and tears to see that their vision grows. In contrast, if we sense that our leaders would sooner sacrifice our lives to protect their interests, we sense that they would sooner, you know, force us to suffer that they could protect their salaries or their bonuses, then we respond biologically by putting up walls, mistrusting them, protecting ourselves, and trust and cooperation start to break down. What I think is so interesting in this modern day and age is you hear companies talk about innovation up the wazoo, and yet they ignore that the foundations of innovation are trust and cooperation. If people don't trust each other, if they don't feel like they can trust leadership, then they're not going to try new things. If they fear that if they make mistakes or if things don't go according to rules, that they could lose their jobs, then we don't try new things. And innovation fundamentally is about sharing information, sharing successes, sharing failures, working together, helping each other up when we fall over, and the result is innovation. That's what happens. It's really, really funny to me that how often people in leadership positions ignore the fundamentals of leadership when they're trying to achieve their own goals.
We never talk politics on this show, Simon, but boy, am I tempted to ask a political question right now.
Go
but
for it.
I'm afraid to. I don't really even want to, you know, because we don't talk politics. And if I did, I'd probably never. It's a slippery slope. Let's change it a little bit differently. Instead of asking about politics, let me ask you this. The media has created business icons, Roberto Goizueta, Jack Welch. Robert Iger made $43 million at Disney this year. I just saw over the weekend. What do you think of the media's gurus?
So, you know, the choices, you know, it's not just the media. It's the value. It seems to be the values of our modern day, which is we believe that if someone makes a lot of money, that makes them a good leader, right? So let's take Jack Welch, for example, who is often hailed as a great leader that we should all admire and we should all follow his chart. This is from a guy who believed that the way you build a company is you stack and rack everybody, you promote your top 10% of the people whose work contributes to the stock value, and you fire the bottom 10 or 15% of people whose work doesn't directly contribute to the stock value. The result is, if you go look at the stock value of GE, it's like a roller coaster. It's up and down and up and down and up and down. And if you're lucky enough to exit at the right time, you could have made 1,400% on your money if you invested in GE when Jack Welch took over. But he built a company with a weak foundation where the people didn't trust and didn't cooperate, that in hard times, remember, these are the 80s and 90s that Jack oversaw GE. And Jeff Immelt, his successor, said himself that a dog could have run a company in the 80s and 90s. Now, granted, Welch may have done a better job, but these were good times. And we can't judge the quality of a crew based on how the ship performs in calm water. We have to judge the quality of a crew, the quality of a company, how the ship performs in rough waters. And on that standard, GE and Jack Welch's style do not perform as well. GE was built on this weak foundation, and after 2008, they needed a $300 billion bailout from the government. That's not a strong company. You compare that to a company like Costco, where the Wall Street constantly complained that their stock value was flat. And if you looked at it on a quarterly basis, comparing it to GE, GE looked way more exciting, and absolutely Costco was flat, except it was a slow, steady growth. They didn't have layoffs. They contributed huge amounts to their people. They gave them insurance. They paid them a lot better than the industry average. They gave them training. It was a good, strong cooperative company. If you invested a dollar in GE and a dollar in Costco went public in 1984, Jack Welch had been in office about 4 years, you would have made 600% on your money in GE. You would have made 600% on your money on the S&P 500, and you would have made 1,200% on your money in Costco. That's good leadership. Bob Iger, I actually respect, and his people are actually proud that he makes that kind of salary because he's so devoted to that brand, and what he was able to turn around based on staying true to his vision have been absolutely remarkable. I'll give you one amazing example of the discipline of Bob Iger and why he deserves his compensation. So under Mike Eisner, who was before Bob Iger, the company was obsessed with growth and world domination, and with that obsession with putting money before people, money before brand, money before vision, the company went into disrepute and disrepair. We hated Disney. It was lumped in there with the other quote-unquote evil corporations. People didn't like working there. And quite frankly, they made a lot of missteps because they would pursue anything that could make them money. Bob Iger came in and he drew the line. And he said, we have a vision that Walt Disney gave to us, and we have to uphold that vision. And he started by selling off some of the companies that, even though they were profitable, didn't help advance the cause. For example, Buena Vista Pictures, that made R-rated films. What's a company devoted to making good, clean family fun making R-rated pictures anymore? Sold it. And here's, to me, the greatest proof. Disney has never and will never own a casino on the Vegas Strip. They understand the hotel business better than anyone. Plus, they own all of the intellectual properties, you know, the comic book characters, and they own all the Star Wars characters and all the Disney characters. It would be the most incredible hotel ever. It would literally be billions of dollars of free money to the bottom line every year. And they will never do it because it violates what they stand for. And it's that discipline, that willingness to ignore the pressures from Wall Street, do the thing that's right, rather than do the thing that's right for someone else, that I think Bob Iger stands up as a great modern leader that we should admire.
And was Eisner? I mean, you just said some fairly critical things of him at the end of his career. At the beginning of his career,
yeah,
perhaps before Frank Wells, the CFO, was killed in the helicopter crash, he was a hero. Do you think that was a hero in wolf's clothing, or did he change? Did the death of Wells change him? Did he get unchained?
Absolutely. Eisner did great things for the Disney Corporation the first 4 years he was in office, and the death of Frank Wells absolutely, absolutely killed his leadership. Absolutely. And I think it highlights one of the truths of leadership, which is leadership is not a solo experience. Usually, between every public, behind every public great leader that we know, there's somebody lurking in the shadows that's actually their partner that helps make them great. They usually come in pairs. They usually come in teams. You know, Walt Disney himself had Roy Disney, his brother, behind him.
Right.
Walt Disney was the visionary, but Roy Disney actually ran the business. You know, George Balanchine might have been the visionary who reinvented American ballet, but it was Lincoln Kirstein hiding in the background who actually built the organization. You know, Herb Kelleher might have been the guy up front and running around, but there was always somebody lurking behind. There's always someone lurking behind in every organization. And in this case, Frank Wells, his necessary partner, the yin and the yang, when he died, I think Eisner never really recovered, and it absolutely affected his leadership style. Absolutely.
Simon, I could ask you questions all day. Thank you so much for being with us. It's been a real honor. I hope your second book, which is out now, Eaters Eat Last, also sells 400 million copies, just like your first book did. How can people learn more about you? I know they can go to why.com, just like as in the question is why, why.com. Anything else you want to, a Twitter handle or anything you want to throw out really fast?
Well, the website is Start With Why.
Oh, I'm sorry. Start With Why.
That's okay. Start With Why. I don't know where the why.com goes. I should probably have a look. Startwithwhy.com is the website if people are interested in learning more. Leaders Eat Last book. There are TED Talks that go along with both of them if you're interested. And for those small business owners who are interested in actually learning their why and articulating their vision in the manner that will inspire their people, if you go to startwithwhy.com, we have something called the Why Discovery Course, which is built specifically for individuals and small businesses. And on that Why Discovery Course, it'll help give them the tools to articulate their why so that they too can inspire those around them and really become the leaders they want to be.
Simon Sinek, thank you so very much for being with us today. It's been our honor.
Thank you very much for having me.
And we are out of time for today, but back tomorrow. Be safe, take care, and go make $1 million. Bye now.